Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects. Hello. You've found us again. It's a pleasure to have you here. This is the 169th day of the year. Always the puzzle. What is it that we're measuring? If any of you can help me with that, just sing out. Send me something, masonicaeffects@gmail.com. And this time we're, of course, the excitement is just almost overwhelming. We're almost bursting at the seams here in the studio, as it is. Take a look around. It's our room in our house. The big excitement is we're coming up to solstice, 2017. Where I'm sitting, we're approaching the summer solstice. The day that we sort of look at as the start of summer, however, that really depends on the local climate, where you start the summer. But for our brethren in Australia and New Zealand and the southern or the hemisphere at the top of the earth, as they would say, they'll be waiting for summer until solstice, the 21st of December, of course. So as you fellows, boys and girls, plunge into winter down there, you're getting into fall, I suspect. Enjoy. The seasons come, the seasons go, you and I come, you and I go. It's all good. Accept it for what it is. For the next hour, I'd like you to plunge yourself into that atmosphere of imagination, and then step away from it for just a moment so that we can be in the here and now. And the imagination existing is that location in our minds where our past, our glorious history resides, as well as our aspirations for the future, our hopes and anxieties and tensions. And as you live and breathe, you are in the here and now, and that's the best that we can strive to do. I think we have an interesting commentary for you today. I start off by, sort of having dilemmas and disagreements. I try to filter out when I picking up a newspaper or picking up. Tuning in a channel on the television, some things start to become clearer after a while. The whole term of news, I think, is a bit Orwellian to me. It's not really news to see another accident or another tragedy. I've seen that at my age. I've seen that many, many times. So it's not new. I don't need to gawk to see. Unfortunately, I have, like many of us, impressions of gore and sadness, and it serves no real purpose for me anymore to watch, to witness the suffering and sadness and grief of another human being. I almost feel apologetic. as if I'm an interloper into such a personal experience. And then to have somebody stick a microphone in front of them, I think is disgraceful. It's disrespectful at the very least. But such is life. We have always a sense of wrestling with ethics, with what's important in life, what's vital. I wanted to talk to you just a little bit about just a bit of comparison with the ancient Greeks. If that's, you know, I hope you don't mind that too much. The Greeks, we have a sense of virtues in misery. You have four virtues. The ancient Greeks had five: justice, courage, temperance, piety, and wisdom. I just wanted to think about that. It was Socrates thought all virtues were interlinked, and knowledge into something that was referred to as knowledge of the human good. And that is knowledge that tells us what we do to the world, to make the world a better place. Knowledge of the human good. And that if we do something unfair, if we're unkind, you know, that business where you're saying something thoughtless and unkind in private because you're a clever wag and you can't control your emotion or you can't control your tongue. Well, Socrates was of a mind that those things are untruths, they're your opinions, but they're not truths, that you weren't harming the person, the subject of your vitriol, but because you were doing this, it was damaging your soul. He was a devout man, but, you know, In Greece, there were constant and daily acts of piety. The more expensive and gory the sacrifice, the better, was general rule of thumb. But they were acknowledging that culture. It was very important for everybody within that culture to be adhering to the respect for the gods. There were around 2,000 gods. Each enveloping an aspect or an atmosphere of the human condition. And Socrates went about his business with his worship with great purpose. And of course he would. All of these gods represent an aspect of virtue, and combined they form the knowledge of the human good. But this was not a place where people could fold their arms and sit and just spout, say things that were senseless, although that did happen. The Greeks went to war 431 BC with Sparta. And Pericles got all the people who just called everybody back into the wall, inside the walls of the city. Not a good move. Plague broke out. A third of the population died. Third. And that's when tolerance faded. Can you imagine? And as tolerance faded, that very unpleasant, unsavory character, Socrates, began to gain a stronger audience, a deeper audience. But his method of probing and challenging, you'd think the prima donnas and the crystalline egos that are out there around us and in lodges and perhaps at times in our own minds, us, are challenged by that questioning, that lingering sense that plays on our doubts, that demonstrates that our opinions are shallow at best, often poorly thought out, often defended, the weakness defended with temper, anger. The beacon, you might as well just ring a big bell. you might as well say this, my idea is really poorly thought out, and it's really weak, and it's not worth your attention. And the way that you know that is because I'm being angry because you're challenging it. It's a bit laughable, isn't it? Eh? If it wasn't so sad and if it wasn't so true. But he brought forward very strong emotion. Something odd has happened in our lodges. We really don't allow ourselves much in the way of strong emotion. Strong emotion seems to be that we're fearful. We're fearful, not respectful, but we're fearful, and we have to tolerate these plotting outbursts. That's not in all settings, but it is in settings where there's a level of emotional immaturity. And that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm speaking about the age of a person. There are some jurisdictions where you can see that the philosophy of masonry is a matter of exposing us not only to an external world of beauty, playing a riffing on the opportunity of influencing us, influence, of course, but also providing opportunity for the transposition of new ideas. Some of the hardest things we could possibly do is accepting and wrapping our minds around a new idea. Because so many of us reach an age, and if you've done this, you'll know, you reach an age where you've just drawn that line somewhere on some surface and said, no, these are all the ideas I can cram in there, and I can't handle any new ideas. And as a matter of fact, I don't want a new idea that makes me think. But I've become as lazy as that, the entropy of the human brain. So don't give me a new idea that challenges my status quo, because then I'm an unhappy little human being. I'm quite content to languish in this bliss of ignorance. Sorry, Joseph Campbell, I didn't mean to misuse the term bliss. Here I'm having difficulty with some David Hume. He says David Hume was around 1711 to, he was born in 1711 to 1776. And I refer to people, I'm always sort of, you know, the advent of the, you know, English Grand Lodge was, I don't think that's where the ethic of masonry, the principle of masonry began. But it is a bit of a watershed moment for the order in Britain. When it, you know, like a lot of upstarts, they sort of declare an authenticity that's not really valid. Well, we're the first. Really, I wish it were so. And then we're first because we were richer, we're more powerful, we're part of a colonialist movement, don't you know, at the time. So if we say we're the first, then we are. Except reality teaches us different, doesn't it? David Hume, no slouch at all. Interesting man, interesting thinker. Here. Says, custom then is the great guide of human life. Custom. Convention, manner, it's the great guide of human life. Expectation. Well, there's a lot of places I don't go, a lot of lodges that I can't go because I'm overwhelmed. I don't know how to control the distraction of the immodesty, the ridiculousness of some people around. I know that it's probably worthwhile that I sit there and learn tolerance, but I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to have to go to where I'm looking for a connection with the things that are most important in life and have to tolerate somebody else's, you know, tediousness. I'm not too interested in that. You know, it's just times and things change, don't they? And we change with them. I don't longer have to be a neoliberal because that's the thing to do, or a libertarian because that's just the pressure of the peers around me. Nor do I have to be conservative in my thinking because some pompous old fart might take offense with it. So be it. I like to reason things through, and sometimes I surprise myself. And I like to be encouraged in that way of approaching a life by the wonderment that's brought to my attention through Freemasonry, through the teachings of Freemasonry. Always the opportunity. Is there an agenda? Yeah, there needs to be some guidance. It's always important. You come in as an apprentice, and somebody says, well, here, now you're an apprentice. Stone cutter. Well, what do I do? Well, that's really up to you. You know, enjoy the journey. By the way, there's a quarry over there, and there's some tools. You go and figure it out. I think that's mean-spirited, and we can certainly do better than that. I'm thinking more that this is a matter of bringing somebody into a studio with great sculptors or artists. Or you, for whatever reason, have been accepted at the Pythagorean school. Well, Daddy and Mommy have brought me into the world in a position of some privilege. And they've taught me that I should have some privilege over people around me. Pathetic, but true. It happens all the time. And what do I do with that? Well, I leverage that to improve and better myself somehow, socially or financially. And then in some way, selective piety, you know, selective, with a selective morality that is made to fit the situation. I declare, by golly, you know, everybody has the same opportunities in life. I really started off from disadvantage. I started off like everybody else. Keep telling yourself that. It's a good way to justify the problem of poverty being the problem of the poor. I'm just fanning a deck of tarot cards in front of me, so that's all. Yeah, well, and I've picked up a reverse card, Nine of Swords, for those that matter. Just to give me a sense of what's going on, how this is going to unfold around us. So let's get into, you know, a little bit of a refrain today. We'll talk a bit about the age of reason that sort of ended in, you know, sort of the age, the so-called age of enlightenment. And maybe I'll even talk, yeah, let me talk about a poet of the period, eh? Alexander Pope. It's been over a year since we made any reference to him. Here's just to give you a little bit of idea that he was the person that's given credit for the line, to err is human, to forgive is divine. Sort of one of those things about our faiths, not the distortions that are made of the writings and the faith, none of that. But the truths that are contained in it. As he says, pride is still aiming at the best houses. Men would be angels, angels would be gods. Aspiring to be gods if angels fell. Aspiring to be angels, men rebel. We always strive to do a little better. Here, this is just a little bit of music to treat you and the minds. And yeah, music is found to improve, actually grow brain capacity, yeah? Volume, temporal lobes. So wherever you are in the world, thank you for tuning in. And sit back and enjoy. This is a woman, Andrea Montes. You may have heard her on the program before. And this is from a show that she was doing in 2009 in Barcelona.
Won't you come go with me down the Mississippi? We'll take the boat to the land of the sea. Come along with me down to New Orleans, out about the 6 8 hours. I'm telling you, there's no fit as a string. What all them characters from through the streets they meet. New Orleans, land of dreams. We never miss the rising, but why it's up to New Orleans. They'll be hanging and kissing, and all the music, love the music that's living. New Orleans,
the blue. Yes, Basin Street is the street where the folks all say meet. Yes, in New Orleans, land of dreams. Baba, that those were for who touch me, Bobby, baby. Here's a dream swinging on Basin Street. But this day, Baba, that over the sea, Baba, that is for me, that day. Oh, Baba, that Baba, do you? Baba, that Baba, what is that? Baba, that is Baba, did be Baba. Stop, 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 Baba, did be me, 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 be
That's sax you heard. It's her. Very cool. Here, help me with this. Conscience is unrelenting. Unassailable master without a thought. Socrates is telling us that democracy only works if the members are educated. I think Socrates made a mistake. I think he meant to say masonry only works if the members are educated. What do you think? Here. Conscience. This is what I had in mind when I was putting together the commentary for this week. Intrusions. It seems, despite ideology and power cultures around the world, power cultures are unable to slip fully out of the grip of conscience. Just can't create mayhem without a conscience hanging on. Fears, unless you're psychopathic, we can pretend. But those recantation at the steps of the gallows are infamous. Fears turn to anger. Anger turns to danger. History becomes a pawn to be used and abused to justify unconscionable acts. If we listen very carefully, we can hear the resonating sound, the echoes of bombs and guns and warfare, carnage, slaughter. Listen very carefully. It's a few thousand miles away. You hear the agonized gasps as somebody gives up their soul. Natural law should be so kind to humanity. When we speak of the corpus, we ask repeatedly, have we progressed? Peaks and quarrels tend to contort the ego. Unable to control emotion allows us to glibly opine that we have not. We have not. And then we have what I consider the embodiment of conscience, beyond our practical illusions, even outside our design. The presence of natural law becomes our teacher, our mentor, our guide. Somehow, thinking in terms of black and white might be the antithesis of masonry. Masonry is a debate in which ethics and principles measure who we are and who we seem to be internally and externally. We adorn ourselves with symbols. Even our quite private gathering places challenge us to achieve harmony and balance. Harmony and balance. Surely we must tell our apprentices that the true Mason begins in a mind that lacks understanding. The beginning, that raw clay to be molded. Put aside what we've learned up to then. We're in for a new experience. And are you opening your mind to this pathway of knowledge and understanding that's been proven through the ages? Or have you superimposed your own ego? Everything that I know is right and pure. Sad that you give up the opportunity so cheaply. We begin with approximations of lofty principles. We do. Temperance, truth, authenticity, honor, dignity, self-sacrifice. And then perhaps the greatest indulgence of all, our indulgence, charity, that private charity that with no names attached, nobody can trace it back to you. How many men of principle? Well, I'm talking to you. I'm talking to that man of principle who commits these features of masonry and doesn't bring any attention to himself, not the lout. I have a picture of the lout in mind, a garish gold expensive wristwatch and rings and the son of a Mason, making sure that everybody pays homage to that fact. But a bit of a fool, to tell you the truth. We begin with approximations of those lofty principles. Approximations. Yeah, everybody knows what temperance is. But in a way, it's like looking at the card. I'm looking at the nine swords and the person waking up with their hands and their head as if from a nightmare, as if some degree of judgment. And the battle on the side of his bed, carved into the foot. At first glance, yeah, it's the guy waking up, rubbing his face. We do the same with the principles. And we do this because we're not uniform in our construction. When we're taught as if instead of being encouraged, we use our scriptures as if it's praise of the human condition, that you are what you are and there's no need to progress any further. Masonry, on the other hand, is a different kind of ideology, a different kind of philosophy of living. It refers to the man as audacious, not comfortable. Its teachings are founded on the principles of encouragement, not praise. Praise, you're wonderful. You did the best job. This is something we say to our seven-year-old at their play. You hear parents doing that all the time. Let's take pictures. What's the child to read from that? Ah, I'm perfect. I've done everything right. I don't have to try real hard. I don't have to try harder. I've reached my potential because mommy and daddy think that I'm perfect. And so does Gran, and so does all the neighbors and everybody around. Oh, I'm perfect. Look at this praise. I just thrive on it. And yet in the background, there's somebody saying, you know, your homework and your study and your practice really paid off. Reminding the child that they did what they did because of a great deal of effort, not because they're anything special, not because they've reached any degree of perfection. They're a kid. They're clueless, like kids are clueless. Children don't come with a full vocabulary and a university education. They don't come with any baggage. We have to pass that on to the little rascals. Children, the beauty of children is the soul and the potential, the opportunity, the purity. You and I are not uniform in our construction. We are the hoi polloi. Now remember the Greeks, the agora. Everybody went to the agora, the market, right? Decisions were made. Every one of us could be a judge. And a judge in serious crime, over serious crime. And if we were a bit clueless, if it was the butcher that was a bit clueless, but he was chosen to be the judge that day, he could be sentencing somebody to death who was completely innocent. And did. Because he didn't like the person or he had a personal issue. Another agenda. Didn't have the reason to recuse, to withdraw from the case. Do you know at the Agora, you had to be at least 18 to even get in there? Because you were just a rascal. A dilettante. Who needs that? Nobody did. The childishness was kept deliberately out of the Agora. So it was a feat of maturing, a feat of an age of passage, even to be in the presence. And do we do this with masonry? Look around. Look around. It's not that we can't or there's any reason not to, but are you stepping up and doing it for somebody else? And are you doing it in a typically preachy style that is just off-putting? Or are you doing it in a way that's conversational and engaging? Well, if you've not yourself been exposed to effective mentoring, you don't know the style. You haven't been taught. Oh, these days you can research it. You can do a little bit of work and learn, watch the experience, and pick up ideas from some pretty good mentors that are out there. And all that's doing is it's not changing, it's enhancing or refining. If you look at it as change and that it's the some loss of your instinctive style, your natural style, well, go ahead, stay away. But if you're thinking, is there a way that, you know, I can offer my, be a better, more aware and insightful instructor? Well, you need some feedback from somebody, but you also need to have the ego that can handle it. Instead of throwing your little jazz hands up in the air and saying, oh my goodness, don't ever say to me that I'm imperfect in every way. Look at me, I have money in the bank, and I drive that a more expensive car. There, you know, there's hubris in my life. Laughable, isn't it? So you begin with these approximations of our principles. We are the cacophony of talent. You think of every one of us having a voice. And it's not a choir, it's just sound. And it's of a sound of talent. Now, what does talent sound like? What does desire sound like? Yeah, we're going to grant to you, whether your head is full of wool or not, or whether your heart is completely empty, we're going to implant the notions of that you have talent, that you have a desire to learn, and that you have valuable and sincere opinions. Have you been taught? Has anybody listened to you when you were growing and treated your opinions as if they had value? Or are you always criticized, never could do enough, idea never quite full, effort never quite acceptable? That's just mean. Not right. That may have been the way that you were taught, but that's not necessarily the way the world operates. But it is part of it. And some person with a meager personality will always be trying to emphasize that that's the way the world is. The world is full of mean, nasty, fearful people. Because they're carrying some of those aspects themselves. By today's standards, though, Masons are that sense, in that sense, the embodiment of intrusions. You and Freemasonry is an intrusion into these notions. We're not praising you as being perfect in every way, but encouraging you to strive through insight for a greater grasp on the importance of life and friendship and love. We share opinion and ideas freely in a free fall threat to despotism, demagoguery, and superstition. Oh, you are the threat. You are the threat. And if somebody challenges you and say, my goodness, are you a threat to the despot? Are you a threat to demagogue? Oh, not me. You know, no, I'm too stupid to be a threat. Well, sorry, all of the did you take obligations and oaths? Yes, many times. And these symbols that adorn you, are they if nothing, a contradiction to superstition? Well, yes, they are then. But I'm really too stupid. I haven't studied anything. My head's my feet are clay and my head's full of wool. It doesn't quite work. We stand in silent oration, an embodiment of harsh, unequivocal truths. You and I. We. Freemasonry is a humbling experience. In front of the principles and the embodiment of Freemasonry, we are frail. And in those admissions, we find tremendous strength. There's no weakness in Freemasonry. There's understanding. There's vulnerability. And above all, you, your brethren in Lodge, your commitment to your Creator, you're an audacious lot. Don't know when to stop. The plundering of souls that go around aren't off-putting for you. Not a bit. So, does this answer the question? Is the conscience an unrelenting, unassailable master? Whew. Sorry about that. Remember, it's just mesmerizing. Just mesmerizing. That's a in the background. That's a kids' orchestra. The horns are all kids. Just they've got the groove, haven't they? Just amazing. Here, just like you, just amazing. Here's a little passage from a little something you probably already memorized. Sorry to be so tedious here. You've memorized Utopia, you know, Thomas More's work. Of course, Heath Chiffetz has. I often hear us quoting it over a beverage. Are you kidding? We know a bit about the work and how pivotal it was in contemporary thinking. Here's a little portion that makes us think, and it's going to lead us into a little bit of a perspective on the Age of Enlightenment and the Age of Reason. Thomas Paine, one of my faves. It says here, these are their religious principles, that the soul of man is immortal and the God of his goodness has designed that it should be happy, and that he has therefore appointed rewards for good and virtuous actions and the punishments for vice to be distributed after this life. So I think it's saying something about the idle rich, the stupid rich in a way. Though these principles of religion are conveyed down among them by tradition, they think that even reason itself determines a man to believe and acknowledge them, and freely confess that if these were taken away, no man would be so insensible as not to seek after pleasure by all means possible, lawful or unlawful, using only this caution, that a lesser pleasure might not stand in the way of a greater, and that no pleasure ought to be pursued that should draw a great deal of pain after it. For they think it the maddest thing in the world to pursue virtue, that is a sour and difficult thing, and not only to renounce the pleasures of life, but willingly to undergo much pain and trouble. If a man has no prospect of a reward, and what reward can there be but for one who has passed his whole life not only without pleasure but in pain, if there is nothing to be expected after death? Yet they do not place happiness in all sorts of pleasures, but only in those that in themselves are good and honest. Good and honest. More is picking up the thread of the Greek development of the inner man, the inner person, yeah? It's kind of uncanny when you start to know a little bit about it. The richness of a person is not the number of coins or the size of the coins in the pocket. That is remarkable. To think that way. So that being the case, why are there so many unhappy people pursuing escapism? Why are the obscenely wealthy, the oligarchs, being mocked? How can they sleep at night with the suffering that they bring about because of their wealth? You really have to be entrenched in a culture that espouses hubris to get away with that, don't you? It's funny. I think it's odder today than it ever has been. We've been sipping on the tincture of the Enlightenment for some time. It was an intellectual and philosophical movement that dominated the world of ideas in Europe in the 18th century. And it included a range of ideas centered on reason as a primary source of authority and legitimacy. Maybe it wasn't Louis XIV, the French king. The divine right of kings, born by birth, born to divinity. In France, the central doctrines of Les Lumières We're into light. Huh? We're individual liberty and religious tolerance in opposition to the absolute monarchy and the fixed, that rigidity of the Roman Catholic Church at the time. The Enlightenment was marked by an emphasis on the scientific method. What do we learn from our mistakes? Experiment. And reductionism, along with increased questioning of religious orthodoxy. It was the there's a phrase that was used that I think may fit well on the walls of our lodges or the lodge of our mind. It's dare to know. Around 1715, Louis XIV died, and in 1789 it was the beginning of the French Revolution. 1789. And some more recent historians begin the period of the Enlightenment around the 1620s, even with the start of the scientific revolution. Now, oh my goodness, during that period, these ideas circulated through meetings of scientific academies, Masonic lodges, literary salons, coffee houses, and printed books and pamphlets. The ideas of the Enlightenment undermined the authority of the monarchy and of the church, and it paved the way for political revolutions of the 18th and 19th centuries. We exist where we've taken away that sense of challenge. In a way, it's almost as if we've become plodding herds of sheep, that as if the advances that were made in that period is all, that there, from that point on, we become sycophants. We become disciples of that movement of the 18th and 19th century. No, the design of these ideas never included that. Never, because these ideas, the impact, hadn't unfolded. Now we have hindsight that teaches us the value, and we're parsing it together, and we're making statements, we're defining, we're creating a narrative that defines value of these ideas, these periods of philosophy. The expansion of the challenge. Now, have we lost that? Not entirely. Not entirely. But it comes at a risk. Stepping out from from tradition, stepping out of the culture of the power of the monarch or the church, do you not think that was dangerous? Do you not think that was a risk? Now, look around us. And are we all dressed up ready to take risk? Certainly not. This wasn't picking up a club and walking around the streets knocking heads. This was the endorsing ideas, new ideas that were challenging status quo. And history here tells us that this continued on. Where these ideas were being talked about was within, thank goodness, the safety of our lodges. Here you are being acknowledged. You're being acknowledged in the same frame of reference as Francis Bacon, René Descartes, and John Locke, and Baruch Spinoza. These are great thinkers. Voltaire, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. There you are. There we are. In scientific clubs, the coffee houses. You know, we've talked about that on the program earlier, where ideas were exchanged, where law was practiced, where insurance began, where people could go and gain services and exchange ideas. And look what came of it. Was there a reason? Well, you have to think that through. It would be such a, it's only a child at our age, at a mature age, we'd be accepting the ideas of somebody else. So when the writers got together in their salons, they were talking and exchanging ideas. They were sitting there saying, oh, you know, we're all, how many of us have been compliant this month? Well, everybody put their hand up. How many of us have fallen into a step with all of our neighbors? Put your hand up. No, of course not. Of course not. The Age of Enlightenment was a powerful, galvanizing point. And then nothing stopped. Then there began an investigation of theology. The Age of Reason presents common deistic arguments. The corruptions. Look, when you look at these organizations, oh my goodness, we can't criticize them because they're large in every way, and they can suck the oxygen out of our lungs if we dare to challenge. You know that Paine was writing for and supporting George Washington. I don't mean the United States as it is today, but the United States as it was in intent, the beauty of the concepts. I supported it. And this was, again, an intellectual context, the intellectual risk. Somewhere mocked as radicals. Somewhere, men of conscience, men asking serious, legitimate questions, touching on a nerve. And what did they expose? Well, we know what they exposed. They exposed the disillusionment. This wasn't people content with the powers that be, with the estates. People were disillusioned. In other words, the efforts to teach people to share ideas and have them comply and agree with those ideas had failed because the ideas themselves did not match with the experience. Good Masons everywhere will remember their studies of the Seditious Meetings Act. And the Treasonable Practices Act, and how we just skirted that because of connections, made an exception, you know. So what have we become? Now, as time, you close your eyes and move through the ages with Masonry. Now, did Masonry begin? Do you think that the strength, the power of Freemasonry began as a sigh, as a bowed head of compliance, you think, of a desire to fitting in as a competition to be the good boy. Do you think that's really what was going on in the salons and the coffee houses? Do you really think? I don't. I'm sorry. I think it was a collision of ideas. And where you argued, you had an opportunity to hear either you were articulate or there were orators that could talk expound and explain your idea much better than you. Where you saw the idea battered, where you saw it debated, and where people in the room got it. This wasn't a place for louts to pull out their billy clubs and start bashing heads because people didn't agree with them. We're not going to put the dogs on you. Although that was tried, there was always that risk. Always, always that risk. The streets were dangerous in this day. What would be more rewarding than having an opportunity to get together with each other and have a few drinks and listen to the debate and argument and agree for the sake of agreeing and being part of a club, because that was de rigueur, that this is where we'll come to argue these ideas, that this is where we'll come. And for the outside world, this is a period of refinement. For us inside, we're boys growing into men, trying to learn, trying to do it better. We don't hear about the utter abject failures, the experiments that went nowhere. So when you hear that around you, Look around and see the successes. Look for it. It is always there. And when you see the decline, or you see the difficulty or the strain or the bitterness, accept it for what it is. It's an experiment gone wrong. That's all. The scientific method. These lodges are living, you and I are part of living experiences. And we learn, if we're at all more than just a bag of words, we're saying that we learn from the science, what science gives us. Was our theory, was our hypothesis accurate? Is it, was their findings, was it partially accurate? What did we learn from the failure? We learned that every failure takes us one step closer to our goal. For all the literalists out there that only can think about the alchemists as silly, ridiculous people, can't really help you. That's like saying golf is just, you know, a waste of time trying to bang a little round ball into a hole. It's so much more. Or walking into an art gallery and not understanding what emotion and what intellect, what ideas an artist is trying to convey to us. Or sitting in a theater in a darkened house and listening to an actor recite lines that have been with us since the 14th century and experience the power of the emotion that is brought forward. You're part of that celebration, and I'm so grateful that you tuned in again today. I look forward to having you join us next week. We've got another interesting series of questions. Help me understand this. The sense of conscience and the grip it has. Oh, we're far better than any reality TV. Truth is, we're the real thing. Check this out. This is from Danish Radio Jazz Group. And thank you. Thank you, France. Thank you, South Korea. Thank you, Poland. Thank you, Norway. Thank you, Australia. Thank you, Scotland. Thank you, England. Thank you, Canada. Thank you, United States. Thank you, brethren, one and all. Fabulous. Thank you.
Thank you.